now of Culpeper. Dr. Weaver, I understand that you practiced medicine in Madison and in Stanardsville. Is this correct?
Yes, ma'am.
Did you treat any mountain people while you were doing this?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. How did they get in touch with you?
Various ways. One of the common ways would be through the missions who had telephones and through the stores who had telephones. The people themselves rarely did, but they would come down to the store and call me and I would go.
Okay. Now, like, would they call you, like, from Nethers or from Syria? Or where would they call you from?
Well, when I was in Madison,
yeah,
I didn't see as many mountain people as I did later in Stanisville, but I saw quite a few, and Dr. Ross was at Kriegersville then, and he got a bunch of them because he was closer to them than I was.
Mm-hmm.
But when they wanted to contact me, they would call from Syria or Kriegersville or one of those places.
Yeah, and then would you have to go by horseback or walk up to them?
I could get most places by car and walking a short distance when I was in Madison. Now, if we're going to talk about Stanisville, that's where I saw most of the mountain people, and my stay in Madison and experience there will constitute a very small part of what I expect to tell you.
Okay. So then when you were in Stanardsville, the people contacted you how? First of all, why did you go to Stanardsville from Madison?
Well, I was during a depression, and I went to Madison for economic reasons after an internship. I graduated the University of Virginia in 1932, and interned a year and had a short surgical residency. And I went to Madison largely for economic reasons, because I intended to later get further education in medicine. I left Madison. I was in partnership with Dr. Jan Kaur in Madison, a very grand, popular, dedicated general practitioner. And after being there a year, I found out over at the university one night when I was over there seeing some of my friends that Dr. Davis, who was the only doctor in Stanisville and the only one that was active in Greene County, had a serious illness and probably wouldn't live. Soon after that, he did die. And I went to Stanisville and made arrangements with his daughter and family to take over his office and automatically got his practice.
Oh, I see. Now, did that change the mountain people that you took care of? Did you take care of different ones then than what you had in Madison?
The Madison and Stanisville, well, I'd have to answer that like this. The people in Madison, for the most part, Madison County and Madison, the town of Madison, there were a large number of Germans. Lutheran Valley near Madison was a home of many of them that were associated with Governor Spotswood's activities down around Germanna. They were well-to-do farmers that were fairly reliable, and many of them were quite well-educated. The mountain people were not as numerous, and they weren't as closely related, in my opinion, to the Madison people as they were in Stanisville. Now, in Stanisville, I felt that more of the people in Stanisville and in Greene County had close relations with mountain people. Many of them had come out of the mountain and were living in Stanisville.
Oh.
And I felt that the communication at that time with the outside was not quite as on the same plane as it was the people in Madison County.
Well, that's a fascinating fact.
If it is a fact. I mean, yes. That's
well, it's your opinion, but I mean, that's a fascinating theory. Now, the people, when you were in Standardsville, Dr. Ross was still working.
Now, Dr. Ross was practicing in Kriegersville.
Yes.
Which is between the mountains and Madison. And I mentioned him simply to point out that he took care of the mountain people pretty well when I was in Madison. But in Stannersville, I was the only doctor in Stannersville, and the only one in Greene County. And the people in the park and in the mountain area went either to Stannersville or to Elkton, where they were one or two doctors.
Mm-hmm. Can you recall any of the names, the family names that were in that area?
Lamb, Breeden.
You were in with a rough bunch.
gosh, I wish you'd asked me that sooner. I had time to think them over and jot them down. Taylor.
Meadows.
Meadows. Let's see.
Were there any Dodsons?
Dodsons? Now, Dodson name I associate more with the Madison group than I do the Greene County group.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Incidentally, since I've been back here 7 years, I have people come in my office, and as soon as they give me the name, I can usually come pretty close to telling where they came from. And I'll say, where did you grow up? Well, I grew up in Orange, or I grew up in Fredericksburg or somewhere. And I said, but your father didn't. Your father was probably from Greene County. Yes, he was.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
So the names are closely identified with each geographical area.
They were, very definitely. Did you go into Jolet Hollow or Long Naked Creek ever? No. All right, now, how far up the mountain would you have to go to treat these people?
I would go over the mountain even. You see, the Spotswood Trail goes from Stannersville over to Elkton.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the patients I saw are on the green side, on the east side of the Skyline Drive. Sometimes, however, I'd go on over and have cases on the opposite side of the mountain. Is that the question?
Yeah. How much did, number one, did you get paid for going? Did they have money to pay you?
Now, are we talking about the Madison people or the Green? Or the
Any
Green?
One of them.
Well, as I've indicated, the Madison people were pretty thrifty. Some of the Green people were. The mountain people may or may not be. I mean, I'd go up in the mountain and it'd be a house that was spotless, and the people around were, you know, attractive and handled themselves well and paid the bills. And it'd be a house within 200 yards that was just the opposite. In connection with charges, I tended to charge what I thought the traffic would bear, because in a location like that, the people just didn't have many ways of getting a lot of cash, especially during the these times when this was right in the middle of the Depression. And I would charge $1 for office visits. Sometimes they'd come in, and if they had 75 cents or 50 cents wrapped up in a handkerchief and I could see it and I knew that's what they intended to pay, I'd charge them that. And of course, some of them didn't charge anything. I've practiced on some people that owed me money and would bring me some squirrels every once in a while or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody, I would say, I wouldn't say nobody, but with few exceptions, they didn't have much money. Now, the people in the mountain and in the foothills that I dealt with, many of them would have a little farm, they'd have an orchard, they'd have a couple of dogs around, especially if they have a coon, a possum hunters around, they'd have a cow, maybe several cows, they'd have horses. And some of them would, they cut bark, and that was the way they made money. A few of them were making liquor, moonshine. Some of them would go out when they could get work to the small towns and make some money doing that. Mm-hmm. Of course, when the Civilian Conservation Corps came in, when Roosevelt came in, that was a tremendous thing for these people.
It
they
was.
Had cash for the first time, and they could really, you could see quite a change. Now, to anticipate myself and go ahead a little bit, after I'd been away for a number of years and came back, and we'd had the Second World War, with the economic changes there, and these people had been moved out to Madison and the areas around, I could see that their standard of living was tremendously better, and they showed all the signs of all this change that had taken place.
In other words, you feel it was to their benefit that they were moved out.
I don't know that I can answer that. I can't see. Well, I don't know. Because I suspect that the reason they were up there was because they happened to be the people in their group who sort of went where life was easier for them. And I think it probably the diffusion that they were able to come across by coming out has helped them in many ways, would be my guess. Whether they're better off or not is a sort of a philosophical question that I wouldn't want to ask.
Okay. What particular things were you, have you any, were there any main things that you were called in for?
Yes. I treated foreign bodies in the eyes, nosebleed, infected ears, sore throat, tonsillitis, cuts and bruises, high blood pressure, heart disease. Pneumonia, that was one of the most serious things we treated because we didn't have antibiotics then. And 1 year, I treated 33 cases of mobile pneumonia, and three of them died.
Wow.
That's a 10% mortality, which incidentally was a pretty good mortality. And it wasn't because of anything I did, because there wasn't much I could do. But if they got well, you felt like you were a real good doctor, and if it didn't, you felt pretty bad.
Right.
I remember one man, when his 20-year-old son had died with lobar pneumonia, came in my office one day, and he wasn't unpleasant about it, but he said, Doc, says, you know, Dr. Davis worked in practice in my family for many years, and said, we never had anybody die before.
He didn't realize the seriousness of what the boy had had.
Now, we also had measles and whooping cough and many obstetrical cases. I remember delivering three women obstetrical cases one day. And a thing that is interesting medically, I don't know if it'd be interesting to
yes.
you about, but at that time, the older doctors were still doing vaginal examinations and examining a woman at term who was going to live. We were taught, of course, to do rectal exams because of the question of infection.
Mm-hmm.
It wouldn't make so much difference now because you have antibiotics, but I don't know. I imagine obstetricians still do rectal in the examination. Now, you may be interested in some of the drugs that we used at that time.
Yes.
We used digitalis. I digitalized patients. Some caffeine for heart disease. Aspirin in several colors. We dispensed our drugs, and in my office I had blue aspirin, pink aspirin, green aspirin, and white aspirin.
But the same sugar-coated pills, I did.
We give them to these people, and never felt that you were deceiving them.
And no.
They had urotropin for kidney and urinary tract infections, lactated pepsin, and for stomach problems, Brown's mixture and charcoal for coughs, Luminol, sodium amytal, sedatives, Arzerol, mercuricone for cuts and bruises, and so forth.
Did you ever find that some people were in pretty bad shape because they had tried to doctor themselves with their own herbs?
I wouldn't say that. I would answer that like this. I don't recall seeing any harm done by drugs that people took on their own unintentionally. But I would say that I saw many people that were neglected, and I think that if they had been treating themselves, it just increased the time that they took before they got to somebody who could diagnose them and treat them right.
Don't you think a lot of this lobar pneumonia was due to them saying, well, we'll put a poultice on him and this will make him better?
I'm sorry, I disagree with you.
Oh, good.
Lobar pneumonia comes out of the blue. Nobody knows what causes it. Well, they know what caused it, the pneumococcus. But, I mean, it does come when you've been exposed to cold weather, fall in a creek and get wet and that kind of thing. But I wasn't impressed that there's anything that I can point to that causes lobar pneumonia. Mm-hmm. Now, when the people, the poultices that you were talking of, onion poultice, cow dung poultice, various oils on flannel that were put on the chest, were used in spite of what I would do, and except for being unpleasant and working around, I never felt that they did any harm. Mm. Of course, to say if they try to treat a lobar pneumonia for 4 or 5 days like that before calling a doctor, I think that they probably did increase the mortality like that.
Yes. Did you know of any herbs in particular that they used? They have mentioned that they would make various teas out of all different type things. And one would be used for coughs, and one for something else.
No, ma'am. I don't have any information on that at all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Did you ever hear of them using rabbit oil for earaches?
No. The only thing of that nature that I've ever seen used for earaches would be salt in a hot salt and a warm salt in a sack that they put on the ear, and probably did have some benefit. The heat is what's beneficial,
mm-hmm.
But the salt was thought to be especially useful. You see?
Yeah. Just yesterday with Mrs. Meadows, I heard that they would use skunk oil for colds. They make a poultice and put skunk oil on it. Mm-hmm. Have you ever heard of that?
I had one man use a term one time that I'd never heard before since. His child had pneumonia, and he was getting along fairly well, but after 2 or 3 days, the father became impatient, and he said, Doc said, now you don't think this child is liver grown, do you? And L-I-V-E-R-G-R-O-W-N was what the way it sounded. I told him, no, I didn't think so. I'd never heard of it before, never heard of it since. And I don't know what he meant or how he got that term.
Yeah, I wonder what it was.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Regarding the people themselves, were you ever called in to, patch up wounds of any kind?
There was an awful lot of cutting and shooting and fighting, and the wounds that resulted from that many times. I was called to 8 murders during the 2.5 years I was out. They called me because they seemed to think it was a thing to do when anybody had been killed. I don't recall the details, but about 4 of them. I had a lot of cuts and bruises to sew up. There were quite a few automobile accidents. Some farm injuries. I remember one woman that whose dress caught on fire standing in front of the fireplace, and she died from general burns. I don't know whether she would be able to survive now or not, but in those days, we couldn't do much about it, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, you know, they've never mentioned burns. What did they first do for her before you got there?
Nothing. Very painful thing. You see, I was fortunate in having a very outstanding medical center within 30 miles.
Mm-hmm.
And having 1 year's internship and no hospital, there was nothing. I was limited, and any general doctor isn't what he can do.
Right.
You don't do extensive surgical things, but I think what we did best was diagnose things and know what was important and what wasn't. And if there's something important and you could see the seriousness of it, get them into a medical center. Now that's what I did with this woman that had this burn.
Mm-hmm.
They probably couldn't do any more for her than I could.
Yeah, but made you and her feel better as though more was being done. How about snake bite? Did they have many snake bites?
I didn't see any snake bites. I had snake vaccine in my office, prepared for it. And I always felt about it like I do about a tracheotomy now, being a specialist in the unknown folk. I always hope I never will be required to do a tracheotomy in some restaurant or on the bus or somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And I always kind of hoped I wouldn't have any snake bites, and I didn't. I don't remember seeing one.
Mm-hmm. You don't remember seeing snakes?
The snake bite.
Oh. But you did see snakes when you went up there.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Mm. You see, in the area I was in, there weren't many poisonous snakes. As far as I know, the rattlesnake, which is high up in the mountain as a rule, and the moccasin, but the only ones.
Mm-hmm.
Snakes, I won't get into that. I'm not an expert on snake bite.
Right. So, there was no general pattern of diseases that sort of would sweep through entire areas.
Let me give you one example. I had 30 cases one summer of severe headache, temperature of 101, slightly stiff neck, and most of them cleared up in 3 or 4 days. And 3 of them got a very severe permanent paralysis of the arms or legs, or both. I diagnosed, of course, it's easier to diagnose the ones that had the paralysis. I thought all of them had it. I was living in a boarding house, and the son of the lady that was running the boarding house got the same thing. And I told her that I thought that she ought to close it to the outside. And she got furious and said she wasn't going to do it. I called a health officer from Harrisonburg, who came over and looked the situation over, and he was on both sides of the fence. He didn't help much. He suggested that I get a man from the United States Public Health Department in Washington, which I did, and he came up and looked the situation over and did not support me in closing this. Subsequent events and many years of experience since that, and in retrospect, I've always felt absolutely certain that all of these people had poliomyelitis, and that the only ones that were getting a definite diagnosis were those that became paralyzed.
Isn't that something? Now, how did that ever get up into the mountains?
I always thought that it was, and I haven't had anything to support it, and I don't know whether I would, I hadn't thought of it much for years. I had an idea it was from some intermediate host, maybe like some kind of bug or insect or something like that, but I don't know. Of course, the Salk vaccine has made that history, mm-hmm. and there isn't so much research done on what it is now.
Yeah.
But you know, a very tragic thing happened that same summer when I was at Stanisville. And I happened to be going with my future wife, who lived in Madison, which was 15 miles away. And her sister had three children, and they lived in New York. They lived at West Point then. My brother-in-law was at West Point. He was an army man. And they came down this summer, and as soon as I found out they were there and realized about these kids that I was treating, when I came over to see my wife, I never went in the house again. She would meet me at the car because I didn't know what was going on. And don't you know, when they went back to New York about 3 weeks later, one of those boys got poliomyelitis and is still paralyzed in one of his legs.
Well, thank goodness you can't feel responsible.
Well, I don't. I think it's still possible that I had something to do with it, but nobody else has ever thought that, and I don't think it much. But I do think it's a very strange coincidence.
Yes, yes. Do you feel the general health of the people was good?
I think it was just about the same as the health of people anywhere else. I think they neglected the teeth. They diets, I don't think, were always as good as the diets now.
Mm-hmm.
I can't think of them as being helped by the mountain air, atmosphere, and the mode of living and so on there, so that they had a distinct advantage over people anywhere else. If I had to make an uneducated guess, I'd say that it wasn't as good as it was other places.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you feel there were diet deficiencies?
Yeah. And, you know, compared to what?
To hear them talk, they say, we always ate good, we had, always had good cabbage and potatoes, and always had hogs and eggs and milk. And
yeah, well, they did.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it, I remember treating a number of cases of pellagra. There's something they weren't getting.
That's right, yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Were you ever threatened when you went up into the hollows at all? Did you ever have any problem?
I have never, night or day, felt the least bit uncomfortable anywhere up in that mountain. Mm-hmm. I take that back. This was in the foothills. And I was called to see a woman whose husband had beat her up one night. And I was over visiting the girl who became a wife, and she went with me. And she was sitting there in the car. And this man came up to the car to greet me when I got there. He was still at home. He had a shotgun in his hand. And I went in, and his wife was there and had a laceration of the head that I needed to dress. I didn't have to sew it up. And I dressed and took care of it. He stood there by me with his shotgun the entire time. And I had my right hand on my pistol in my pocket the whole time. I said that as close as I came to any instant. And that wasn't in the mountain, but I never at any time felt.
You all have admitted that there was quite a bit of moonshining going on up there in the mountains. Did this cause, do you think, any more quarrels than there should have been?
Well, certainly. I mean, alcohol always causes more quarrels. Are you speaking of drinking it or making it?
Drinking it.
Well, sure. I think any time people drink alcohol, they have to be more incidents of all kinds.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it didn't make them leery of strangers, the fact that they made the moonshine?
Well, we talked, you see, this was during Prohibition. And, no, this was after the repeal. But, are you talking about drinking whiskey or making whiskey?
Making it.
Oh, well, I suppose there was some competition between the people who made it. It was being done illegally. I don't think that moonshining or making liquor was a major cause of fighting and that kind of thing.
Did you find much inbreeding?
I would say, as far as I know, and I don't have the records of that in very many people, but I would say that there's more of it up there than there is outside, and you would expect there to be, because if people were there close together and living together and so on.
Yeah. It didn't seem to affect, at least the ones that I have interviewed, it didn't seem to affect their mental capacities, the inbreeding. Did you find that it did? Because you were there with them. Now I'm seeing almost second generation.
I said I wasn't going to express an opinion on this thing that I wasn't sure about, but I will a little here. Now, I had families that, I remember one family that had three or four people that had held it and kept it out. Well, now, the anthropologists can give you a good case for why that's not hereditary. Well, I think it is.
Mm.
I remember two or three people in one family that had club feet. Now, what I'm talking about now is genetic things. I'm not talking about inbreeding. My idea of inbreeding is that there isn't necessarily any harm comes from it. I think it can be tremendous advantages from it if good qualities and the good genes are the ones that are prominent in the offspring, which they sometimes are.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that the disadvantage of inbreeding is that if you get too many of the bad genes and bad qualities, then that's where your problem comes.
Yes.
I don't have any support or information to contribute regarding inbreeding. Except just in a casual way, and the fact that when people live close together, I mean, even now, we're learning more and more all the time about those things.
Mm-hmm. Right. Oh dear, there was another question. question I wanted to ask you right away. Well, you just go on and you just tell me anything that you recall.
Okay, let me look my notes over here and see if I can see anything I think you might be interested in. Much about charges. I'll give you a rough idea of what I charge people. Now, I charged a little more when I was in Madison than I did in Stanisville because they're a little different class people.
Mm-hmm.
I think the people in Orange and Gordonsville and Charlottesville charged more than I did in Greene County because you had a different economic setup. Office visits, as I said, would be a dollar or even less. The drugs were dispensed. In Madison, we had a drug store. We didn't have one in Stanisville, but most of the drugs that they had, I gave them and charged for them in my office. I'd give tablets and capsules and small envelopes and liquids in bottles of different sizes. Those calls were about $3 close by. If I went up in the mountain and had to ride a horse, it may be at the most $8. And this would take a half day or more.
Yeah.
OB cases were $15 or $20. I remember going up in the mountain once to see a woman that had a baby. And the baby was lying in bed, and the placenta, after birth, was lying in bed too. She delivered them both. Well, I've been in a medical center, and we always, as soon as the baby was born, we cut the cord, and then the placenta was delivered. And I was a little concerned because they were both lying in bed together. Well, after thinking about it a minute and talking to a later OB man, that's a natural way to do it. And actually, the baby gets a little bit of a blood transfusion by getting that extra blood while the placenta is separating, don't you see? So it takes care of itself. As soon as the placenta comes out, the uterus contracts, you see. And that's just a little side thing. It isn't much of a...
No, but it's a fascinating thing.
Now...
Were you ever called on to do any dental work, to pull teeth or anything
like that? Yeah, and I was called on to treat horses, and I remember throwing up a big cut on a horse that had been caused by a boar's teeth, and I spent a long time, I'd put a stitch in or stick a needle in, and the horse would kick at me, and I'd jump back, and I spent several hours doing this, and after I had done it, of course, the stitches all cut through very promptly, and I learned later that there's no use ever sewing a horse up. They always break, don't you?
Mm-hmm. But you weren't of that.
One thing I mentioned about the people up in the mountain that had cars, they had either Model T or Model A Ford.
Mm-hmm.
And those that live high up in the mountain had a practice of when they were coming down, they would cut a cedar bush, or if they already had one, cedar tree and tie on the back of it, and drag that down the mountain and keep from burning the brakes out, don't you see? And I told you about how they got me. Where I was, there was a lower Pocosin
mm-hmm.
mission and an upper Pocosin, and there was a mission at near Fletcher and Kinderhook, and they were the people that had the bones, and then the store. There was a store at Fletcher and a store at Kinderhook, and those people would come down whichever store they wanted to go to. At Fletcher, there was a very, to me, interesting situation. The Civil War was over, and one of the generals, I don't know if I ever knew, asked Mr. Fletcher, who was a VMI graduate, to come back there and teach school. And he did. And he had three children. Now, I think this is accurate. I could be off on part of it about the dates and all, but he had three children, four children. The man that I knew was a very well-known revenue officer during Prohibition, and all the mountain people were scared to death of him because he was effective, he was good, and he got them. And he lived there at Fletcher at this store. And Miss Irma ran the store and lived there at Fletcher. And Miss Irma had a sister that taught school in Norfolk. And there was a young girl in the family that wasn't very well. And I was called to see her one night. And she was having, obviously, some heart disease. She wasn't, it was in her 20s probably, having some heart disease and problems that I felt were beyond this. So I asked Dr. Eddie Wood, who was a professor of cardiology at the University of Virginia, to come down and see her. And I took him up there, and he examined this girl and tapped her chest with a needle. She had fluid. He made a diagnosis of Fick's disease. It's the only case I've ever seen before or since. And Fick's disease is a disease where fluid collects in all the body cavities, perineum, pericardium, pleura, and so on. Well, he withdrew some fluid. The girl was quite sick. And then he digitalized her. He gave her a handful of digitalis tablets. And we weren't too hopeful, but actually, she died soon after that. I don't know how far you want to go on this.
Oh, forever. As long as you want to.
One of the first cases I saw when I went to Stanisville, I was called to see a nine-day-old baby. And when I started to look in his throat, which I always did a routine exam, you know, started looking at his throat, he couldn't open his mouth. And I made some inquiries and found out that he'd been delivered by a midwife 9 days before, and that she had cut the cord with some scissors that just happened to be lying around and were sterile. And I made a diagnosis of tetanus neonatorium on this baby and drove it to the hospital in Charlottesville myself, which occasionally I had to do. And this child's grandmother went along with me. When I had come to Madison, I bought a Model A Ford, used, with the understanding that I bought it from a friend of mine in 6 months. I could trade it in on a new one. I had traded in, and I had a brand new V8 Ford when I started to Charlottesville with this baby and this grandmother. But she'd never been in a car before. And I must have stopped her half a dozen times to let her be sick while we were on the way to Charlottesville.
She was a help.
A case. A child I delivered in Stanisville was bleeding from her rectum, just 2 or 3 days old. And I'd never seen anything just like that. And I called a pediatrician at the University of Virginia. And after consulting him, I withdrew 25 cc's of blood from the mother's arm, injected it in the baby's hip, and cleared him up.
Are you interested in this type of thing? Yes, what was it?
Some kind of bleeding problem that children get. I've forgotten the name of it. I haven't treated it since. But there were some blood clotting elements in her blood that the baby didn't have, don't you see?
Amazing.
I remember, this was well up in the mountain, a case of a woman I was called. This woman was in labor, and I got up there and found that she was having convulsion from eclampsia, and it was difficult to handle because of the emotion and the convulsions and so on. And I happened to have a man with me that used to ride around with me in open gates and just for the company. He was a painter that lived there in Madison. This one has a Madison. And I went over and tried to get him to come in and help me hold this lady something while I took care of her. And he wouldn't have anything to do with it. He said he's afraid some of these men around there would take exception to it, and he kept out of it.
He was right. They would have.
I think they might.
Yeah.
I remember riding a horse up in the mountain 4 miles when the temperature was 4 degrees below zero to see a boy that had tonsillitis. One morning, I was called by a couple, in the middle-aged couple, to come and see the mother of one of them. It's in the summertime, it was called about daylight. And I went out and walked in, and she was in on the ground floor in bed, sitting up in bed. And a couple met me at the door, and I spoke to them and said hello to the patient. And I took my coat off, rolled my sleeves up, and opened my medical bag, and walked over to the patient to examine her, and she was dead. And I don't know how long she'd been dead, and the people there didn't know either. This had nothing to do with mountain people, but it's hit. Do you want this kind of thing?
Definitely, yes.
I was called to see a little girl about 4 years old. She and her sister, who was about 6, had been playing around a stove in the summertime. There's no fire. And the older girl ran and told her mother that her sister was asleep, and the child was unconscious. And I didn't have any idea what was wrong with her. I took her to the University Hospital. She died. And when they did a postmortem, they found this cherry red look that the blood has and tissues have, thinking that she had carbon monoxide poisoning from somewhere. I still didn't have any idea where she could have gotten it. Several years later, I was out at the Mayo Clinic and talking to a pediatrics friend of mine out there. He suggested that she might have drunk cola. I don't know whether that's what it was or not, but that's always been interesting to me. Now, I delivered a baby right in the foothills of the mountain, perfectly healthy as far as I knew, and several months later, they called me one day, and I went up, and the baby was dead. And only explanation I had was that it was what we now call crib death. It's a condition that has we've known about for many years, and I saw no cause for the child's death. So I was glad in a year or less when the mother was pregnant and had another baby, and I delivered it. Several months later, had exactly the same experience. The second one, the same way. I don't know how much you know about crib death, but it's sudden death in children that you don't have any explanation for. There have been any number of explanations. But I recall when I was interning, it was thought to be caused by an enlarged thymus. And routinely, children had to, when they were born, had the thymus x-rayed. And if it looked enlarged, in the opinion of the radiologist, he would give them x-ray treatment. Many of those children in the past 20 years or so have developed cancer of the thyroid gland from their radiation, don't you see?
Oh, dear.
I was caught a wreck one night. This was on the Hard Surface Road 29. And it was a fellow in his 20s lying on the side of the road dead. Not a mark on his body except a piece of glass from the windshield that had stuck in his neck just above his clavicle and hit the jugular, the subclavian vein and or artery, and he died right there. Abortion was illegal then, And it was a penitentiary offense. And no reputable doctor would induce abortion, but there was always somebody on the outskirts that would do it, and maybe it was a good thing, I don't know. But I would be called, and I couldn't do anything about it, when women had gone and had the abortion started, and maybe have a little problem or not have a problem. They might just want somebody there with them, and once you got there, you had to stay, you know, mm-hmm. take care of them. And I was called several times for that, and I remember one of them was a person that I had known and known her family for some time. And she had gotten a bloodstream infection, which they often got. And we all just sat all night until she died. Mm-hmm. I said I'd been called to 8 murders, and I can't even think of 4 of them, but one of them you might be interested in was a man shot with a shotgun, and the charge went in just above his collarbone and his neck. And I went up in the mountain with the sheriff and the Commonwealth attorney, and myself went, and a group of people around, of course, and the Commonwealth attorney said, "Who did this? Where's the man who did it?" And this boy stepped up, 8 or 10 years old, said, "I did it." Well, that practically ended the investigation. I mean, there's a sequel to that that I don't know whether I'll put on record or not, so I saw this boy some afterwards.
Did he grow up all right?
I don't know. I didn't follow him that long. He was smart and fun. I was over to see my wife one night, and I was called to see a woman, and I got there. She was lying in bed and had been shot right through the thyroid gland, was dead. And the story was that her boyfriend had come in and taken her for a walk and shot her through the neck, and then brought her back and put her in bed and covered her up. And I don't know whether he called me or somebody else did. There was an old man that was crippled, but he had a little store. And there was a drunk nearby, mean, and I knew him. I'd been in his home, and there wasn't anything good that I could say about him then. And he would go in and threaten this old fellow. And he never had beat him up, but he threatened to beat him up. So he went in one night and drunk and threatened this guy. And he'd been told that if he came in, he was going to shoot him. And he did. He shot him several times. And when I got there with the sheriff, he was lying on the floor, dead.
It wasn't Gilbert Lamb by any chance, was it?
No.
No. Because he was quite a one with threatening and shooting people.
Well, this fellow, actually, he was shot here. He was shot at the top of the head.
I'm going to make sure you're gone.
Yeah. I just want to see. I don't know. Can you stop that while I look this over? Well, the houses were small, wooden enclosures of a roof, with a shingle or tin roof. And for the most part, they were simply and crudely made and weren't very close as far as the weather was concerned.
Mm-hmm.
There were often cracks in them, and I remember more recently, actually, because I had a farm up there that joins the park. And I still go up in that area, and I remember sitting in the living room and looking up through the ceiling into the room up above. So,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
And this was a better class.
Right.
People. The fireplaces were common, and some of them had wood stoves. Water was obtained from nearby springs or wells, and it was brought in buckets. A few of them had a pump in the kitchen that they would pump water out of.
Oh,
well,
they did.
Hand pump.
Yeah.
most of them had clocks. Most of their furniture was pretty crude. Much of it was many times handmade.
Mm-hmm.
You'd sit on a box or sit on a chair somebody made. They had feather beds, we call them ticks, mattresses. Also, they had mattresses made out of corn shucks and straw. Oil lamps, of course, were universal. And I remember, for some reason, on the mantle of many places, they had a little container with, I don't know the name of the things, but little pieces, little strips of paper wrapped up so that they would be very much the size and shape of a lead pencil. And they were used for lighting pipe, lighting lamps from the fireplace.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
I've spent the night a number of times in those places and eaten there, and usually with pleasure. I mean, they usually were pretty good. If you were suspicious of the place, if it was not too clean, well, you always could fall back on hard-boiled eggs and coffee, you know.
Yeah.
I used to, when I was in Stavisville, this didn't happen real often, but the people that were still living in the park, often, I would drive up on the Skyline Drive, on the Spotswood Trail at Swift Run Gap, and at that time, the Skyline Drive wasn't a hard surface, they were working on it.
Yes.
And it was a dirt road, and I'd pull my car up there, and on some occasions, there'd be a road going down the mountain from the Skyline Drive to these homes that I wanted to go to. At other times, I would either walk or ride a horse. Actually, I didn't have to ride a horse so much there because the distance between the top of the mountain and where most of these people lived, if you had to approach them from up there, wasn't so far. The times you rode the horse was when you came from the foothills
mm-hmm.
up the thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You were a good horseman then.
No, I ridden them all my life, but I never was skillful.
Wow, some of those rocks that those horses had to go over.
Now, the stores that would call me would be General Store at Kennehook, Fletcher, Gear, or Dyke.
Mm-hmm.
They were the main ones. And I've said I'd go as far as I could by a car and either walk or ride a horse.
Did you ever go into Nicholson Hollow or Corbin Hollow?
Yeah, I don't know now where it was, but the names of those hollows are very hazy. I get it mixed up with the hollows around Barbersville. Well, my father happened to be a general practitioner, and I remember during the influenza epidemic of 1918, he would go up in these hollows, Bacon Hollow, Beck's Hollow, and several of them, and I can't identify any hollows, really.
Mm-hmm.
I just don't happen to know where they are. An old lady came in one day with a peculiar spasm in her arm that she would have every 2 or 3 minutes. And that was when I was in Madison. And Dr. Kluwer, whom I was practicing, an older man, thought she was a rather sick woman. I didn't think so. So I let her come back in a couple of days, and it had extended a little. And it was from a wound over her elbow following fall in a chicken house. And we sent her over to university, and she died, and she was diagnosed tetanus. It extended on, so Doc Cole was right about it. You know, when I went in with him, his experience and know-how and bedside manner or what have you was of tremendous value to me, and my recent association with medical centers and medical school and all were of considerable value to him. So we both profited by it during that year. I remember one boy that I was called to see that had a very bad throat, and I made a diagnosis of diphtheria. And I had a young minister with me who was a friend of mine and would ride around with me some. And as soon as I saw it was diphtheria, of course you don't have time to get a culture and get in a report back, you've got to do something about it then. He was quite sick. So I left the minister prayed for him some, and I left him there and went back to my office. Took a trip back to the office and got some tetanus toxin and went back and gave him an injection. I went back 24 hours later and his improvement was tremendous. And I had kept the father posted all along as to what it was from the beginning. But I was kind of amused. He was a little bit skeptical. He said, Doc, I want to speak to you a minute. And we went aside and he said, Doc, now tell me the truth. Now, what do you really think was wrong with that boy?
Did they have much diphtheria?
No. There'd been quite a bit of immunization by that time. I didn't see a lot. One of the most interesting ones I saw was a case of diphtheria of the nose. And it just happened that I got a culture of it the first time I examined the kid, sent it to Richmond, and got a positive report for diphtheria. Out once, rode a horse a long way to see a young woman who had lobar pneumonia. And I would probably ordinarily have treated her, maybe gone back to see her another time or two. But she also had a cardiospasm. A cardiospasm, if you aren't familiar, are you familiar with it?
That's the heart, isn't it?
No. A cardiospasm, the cardia is the opening from the esophagus to the stomach. It's also called a esophagogastric junction. And a cardiospasm is a peculiar contraction of that muscle so that it gets so fluid and food won't go through. Well, this woman had a cardiospasm with this pneumonia. The part of the treatment was to give him fluids and a supportive treatment, which you couldn't give her. She was quite thin from dehydration and starvation too. She hadn't been able to eat what she should have had. So I had some men make a stretcher out of straight poles and burlap sacks and sheets and what have you, and took her over to the university, brought her out, and then she was taken from there to the university hospital where she died. Another time, I went up in the mountain and rode a horse a long ways to see a boy, 8 or 10 years old, who had a temperature of 104. And spots on his body that I never had seen. By the process of elimination, I concluded that he had Rocky Mountain spotted fever and sent him to the University of Virginia Hospital. He died soon after he got there, and the diagnosis was not confirmed. Several days later, I was called to the same home where another boy had the same symptoms, but had not been sick as long. I sent him to the University of Virginia Hospital with the same diagnosis, and it was confirmed, and he recovered.
Now, how much did the University of Virginia charge for these mountain people? They couldn't afford much.
Well, they had what was known as a clinic set up that at that time they'd go for practically nothing.
Oh, good.
Because if they were could pay, they did.
Yeah.
Probably 25 years later, when I was in Michigan, Dr. Cawley, professor of dermatology at the University of Virginia, wrote an article published in the Journal of the American Medical Association on the Rocky Mountain spotted fever seen at the University of Virginia. My cases were not included. I wrote Dr. Coleman, whom I knew slightly and had been on programs with immediately. I wrote him, and he said that the records kept for that period had been destroyed, lost. I don't know what value that is, except I think that I probably saw the first cases of some of the first cases of Rocky Mountain spotted fever that was diagnosed in this area. Now, whether it was here before that, I don't know, because it is a Rocky Mountain thing. It comes from tick bites.
Yes. You wouldn't happen to know, it was around 1930, there's a small graveyard up near Dark Hollow Falls. That would be the other side of Big Meadows. And this small graveyard has only three children in it. They were very young and they died in 1930, which sounds like some sort of an epidemic of some kind.
What was it? In 1930.
Mm-hmm.
And several of them died at the same time. What you're wondering is what it most likely was.
Mm-hmm.
It'd be my guess that measles with pneumonia, because measles, pneumonia with measles was very bad. The children would die. I'd say measles with pneumonia. That was in the 1930s. Whooping cough, possibly, but most of them got well. Three of them died by the same time.
Mm-hmm.
It was too late for typhoid fever. Now, if it had been a generation ahead, that was common, typhoid fever. Could have been a burn. Wasn't an accident, though.
No.
Didn't die in a fire.
No, because then the parents would have gone, too, probably. Well, these are just three, all by themselves. They're little gravestones.
I'll change that a little. I would say diphtheria would come first.
Uh-huh.
And then maybe measles.
With pneumonia.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Can't think of anything else, really. Yeah. Of course, they could have had Rocky Mountain spotted fever that wasn't diagnosed.
Yeah.
You don't know how much of that was around then.
Mm-hmm. You know what you never have finished telling? You were telling about this woman who was having the baby and also having convulsions. How did you handle that finally?
Well, finally we got her delivered and she was okay, because they get better as soon as they deliver.
I know, and I mean, how did you ever manage? That must have been a nightmare of a time.
Well, you just saw Mother Nature take its course.
Oh, gosh. This gave you a very well-rounded practice, didn't it?
Yeah.
The experience was...
Right. I knew that I wanted to go into some branch of surgery, and I had planned or thought I would be a general surgeon. After being out in practice, I decided that general surgeons take more responsibility than I want, and there's a lot of administrative work to it as a rule. So I decided to go in one of the specialties, and fortunately I was able to get a fellowship at the Mayo Clinic and get those throat and head and neck surgeon, facial plastic surgeon. I went up there and was there 3.5 years, and then I went to Ford's in Detroit, was there 10 years, and then I practiced in Detroit another 20 years while I was in the Fisher building and was down at the medical school, and I came back here 7 years ago.
Oh, what a marvelous background you've got. You sure have. And you still own some property there close to the mountains.
I bought that about 20 years ago. As a matter of fact, I've got part of it up the seal now. It joins the park. It's up on Conway Middle River. There's about 60-some acres. I'm going to keep about 30 and sell about 40. Let's see. You know, I've often told this to people, I don't mean to be making fun of these people, but I know one time a lady, old woman was in, and I was taking a history on her, my husband was standing there with her, and I was trying to find out when she had a change of life, when she, so I used several terms. When was your last period of falling off a roof? So finally I used the term flowers, and she reacted to that. She said, oh yeah. And I said, well, when was that? And she turned to her husband, and she said, John, when was he calling in the upper field? I thought it was interesting that she was fixing the dates like that, you know? Let's see, this is his last. I think that about it, unless you got some more questions.
Did you ever hear her you using more flowers and so on, hear any expressions aside from that liver grown, that were uncommon?
I talked to my wife about this, and she thought I ought to have more about these people's home and houses and what's in them and all that. Well, I just don't know much about it, don't you know?
No, I had not expected that from you. I've gotten the most marvelous interview from you.
Well, wonderful. I hope it is.
This is going to be of such great value to everyone.
Well, that's just wonderful.
And we really, really do thank you sincerely.
You should.
Actually, I've had such fine cooperation from all the people. And it's been rather fascinating because there was a lot of resentment against the park. And I think enough time now has passed that the people are not resentful.
Well, you know, I wasn't aware that there was resentfulness until I read the paper today that my wife showed me about these dogs that were killed up there. And reading that article, I got the impression that there had been quite a bit of resentment about the park, you know?
What did it say in the paper? I'm dying to know. I know about the problem, yes.
Are you the interviewee?
Yes, and so you signed.
I see.
What did the paper say? Was it against the park or for it or what?
I'm pretty sure she may want my signature. Yes, she did. I'll put the signature.
You know, those dogs were literally chasing a bear.
They were.
And I have had it on tape that people along that one strip that goes down, sort of almost like a little peninsula. And here's parkland, and here is private land, and here's private land. They'll use the dogs to sweep across that little peninsula, and they'll stand at the other side and shoot the bear and the deer as they come out.
Did you feel, you must know something about it, did you feel that the ranger didn't have much choice?
He had no choice whatsoever, because there were eight dogs actually, chasing this bear on park land. Now, this is illegal.
Was it then imminent danger, would you say?
Mm-hmm. It was being run right off into that private land.
Yeah.
Now, the men claimed that they were not going to shoot the bear. But the ranger has no way of knowing that.
Well, was there any danger of the bear being killed by the dogs?
No, by the people. And since this has been done so frequently.
Well, you see, what was in my paper, it was, my wife, I take all these pictures, I think Madison's town is their own, Fauquier, I think that's run over there. The Madison paper that came, I guess, last Thursday, I had read, but I had missed this. My wife told me about it, so I read it today. And the gist of it was what took place, and there's apparently an awful lot of bitterness.
That's true.
And the, the representative, Robinson, is, there's been some letters and all, and I presume he, that's the way he deals. I think that doesn't help people.
No. Oh, in fact, the park said to me, don't do any more interviews over in Madison County for a while. There's too much feeling there. And I said, oh, well, I don't think that, I know that the men were wrong. I'm with the Humane Society in Page County, and they called me thinking that I would get up in arms and start proclaiming that the park